joining us once again for his regular chat, and that's Mr. Ken Bates. So, morning, KB.
Good morning.
How are you?
Very well, thank you. Sun's shining.
Good news.
A lot of cruise ships outside.
Okay. You're back back home now.
Summer must have returned to Monte Carlo.
Good to be home?
Yes, it's been, yes. At the end of the day, the roads are better.
lots to go through, as ever, and let's start with Leeds United, KB. In the papers once again for all the wrong reasons, with yesterday that Lucy Ward, who won her case for unfair dismissal and sexual discrimination against Leeds United. You obviously know quite a bit about Lucy Ward and Neil Redfern. What are your thoughts after the decision yesterday?
Well, I think she'd been foully vindicated, and so she should be. Lucy was a great servant to Leeds United. In the 10 years I was there, both Susanna and I got very close to her because Susanna's very interested in the welfare of young kids. It's always been, she did it for me, with me at Chelsea as well. And Lucy was magnificent because you have to remember, which people don't sometimes realise, is that of the kids that join an academy, you're lucky if 1 in 10 come through. So that means that 9 kids will spend the formative years at their football club and then have to go out in the real world. And it isn't easy. And where Lucy was very, very good, she made sure the kids at the academy worked hard on their academic lessons as well. So if they're an unsuccessful footballer, they were still, if they're an unsuccessful footballer, at least they had an education ready to hold their own, perhaps do well in some other sphere. And that's very important, and it's part of the iceberg that a football club consists of, which is well underwater, but very, very important. And Lucy was a strict disciplinarian. When I say 9 o'clock, I mean a minute to and not a minute past. One of her favourite phrases. And she got them working and got them, gave them a sense of discipline, but also to believe in themselves, which, of course, you have to have great self-confidence to be a successful footballer, and looked after their other concerns and needs behind the scenes. And I think that the crop of youngsters have come, they're now emerging, have emerged and are emerging still from Thorpe Arch, is a lot to do with her. Neil, her partner, when he ran it, he was very good too. Lucy gave the non-footballing backup. And of course, she knew about football. Wasn't just one of these people that talk a lot and have no experience. But of course, she played for England as a soccer player. And I'm very sorry that she went in the way she went. I'm very sorry that she went at all. And I think it's been a great loss to Leeds, which will become apparent in the future. I'm very glad she's been exonerated. And I'm very glad that, that her reputation has been enhanced, if anything. And I'm sure she'll get a job before long. And it'll be a lucky club that get her. Because I believe that people are chasing for her, rather than having to hawk herself around trying to find an opening. I wish her well. And she is a great loss to Leeds United. But I'm glad that she's come out with her head held high and totally vindicated. I'm sure it came to this.
I think the sad part about all of this, KB, is the way that Leeds United seem to have dealt with the situation. And it's just another story of sort of the off-field problems that Leeds United are having, and that the Leeds United fans don't want to see their club going through.
Well, the real problem seems to be, and at the end of the course, it must rest at Massimo's door. The real problem is, until they appointed Paul Bell as chief executive, or executive director, whatever they call him, they were just a matter of getting rid of people, which, of course, started with the GFH gang, the idiots, just cutting what appears to be costs without realising the implications of what they're cutting. And it's coming home to roost now in many ways, which is unfortunate because of the structure that was built up in the Bates era, for a better phrase, have been totally destroyed, not replaced or improved, but destroyed. And that's why you then get these ill-considered decisions made, and once a posture is taken, or an attitude taken, or a standard, then there's no way out. And that's why there's still so many other cases going on at the moment. It could be somebody should take all these outstanding points, positions by the scruff of the neck and solve them. And then Leeds can move forward next season. But we have these things where don't do it. Very Arab attitude. Don't do it. Leave it long enough to go away. Of course it doesn't. It just gets worse. And the collateral damage is the fear and insecurity it gives other employees who are still working there. So the only hope we can have is that the result of this case and the attendant bad publicity at least will maybe give people time to think and go away, go about things in a different way in the future.
On the field, KB, things looking up just slightly with an excellent performance for Leeds United at Birmingham on Tuesday night. Steve Evans calling it the best he's seen Leeds United playing under him.
Well, thank goodness for that. But that's how he's not damning with faint praise. But we certainly needed a win after that disastrous run. Was it one draw and three defeats? And it's beginning to get a bit worrisome because, as I've said for some time now, once you know you're safe from relegation and you know you're not going to get promoted or in the playoffs, then that's when you start building for the following season, blooding your kids, giving them experience, giving them confidence for the following year. And we've got some good kids, so they need the experience. And perhaps now he'll concentrate on the last four or five games so that he can go into the summer knowing what he's got and what he hasn't got, start planning for replacements or improvements. But it was a good win against Birmingham because not a bad team. They were away from home. I mean, just about, Birmingham had a chance to get in the playoffs, which I think that defeat just about finished their hopes.
Moving on from elsewhere from football, and David Cameron in the news over the last week or so, KB, after admitting that he had some investments in a father's company in Panama. These are the Panama Papers, of course. All sorts of problems for the Prime Minister. I wanted to get your thoughts on what's been occurring for David Cameron.
Well, I think it just goes to show, I mean, I'm no supporter of Cameron. I've been very disappointed with his performance over the last 6 years. But this is much ado about nothing. I had some shares in the Panama company, which he declared. And he got his... If he got dividends, he paid the tax on them. What's the big deal, quite frankly? The fact that he was investing in his father's company, why shouldn't he? He paid his tax. Haven't caught him being a penny or a pound short. I think it's absolute nonsense. All this song and dance have been brought up by the Labour Party. They should concentrate more on being a decent opposition. There are so many important things at stake at the moment, issues to be resolved. You think they'll have more, they concentrate on that instead of behaving like a crowd of baying hyenas on a personal vilification campaign. Should be concentrating on giving us a reasoned argument for why we should vote to stay in the common market. And I'm afraid there hasn't been one decent one yet. Not one specific thing. coming out from Cameron and his supporters. It's all scaremongering. 3 million jobs could be at risk, really. How? We're safer in the EEC from a security point of view. Oh, tell that to the people of Brussels and Paris. Our industries, our steel industry, wasn't saved by the EEC. Our farming industry has been decimated. Our fishing industry has been virtually destroyed. Whereas we used to export fish, we now buy it. And so it goes on. £350 million a week we give in taxes to these unelected, unreportable, unaccountable commissioners. And what people forget, very interesting, the annual accounts of the EEC, European Commission, hasn't been approved and signed off by the auditors for the last 17 years. Can you imagine that in a company or a local council? So all this fiddling and diddling, money wasting and spending, they're getting away with it, tax-free, at Brussels and Strasbourg, and nobody calls them to account. Why the hell does the government, does the commission move from Brussels to Strasbourg every month? Well, I'll tell you why. When the EEC was originally conceived, in its primary form, it was in Brussels. When the French came in, they saw that an affront to their national dignity, so they insisted it be moved between Brussels and Strasbourg, Strasbourg being just about in France. And I just read last week, it costs £130 million a year. For nothing, other than the inconvenience of moving between the two places. £130 million a year. How much good will that do, spent in the right direction? They made a complete mess of the migrants. We are the biggest military force in the EC. That's why we always get involved in the mucky jobs. I remember Luxembourg sending too many soldiers to Syria. We're a thriving, industrious nation. We take off the shackles of the dead hand of regulation, most of which is irrelevant. Our country will be much bigger, faster growing, more international and outward looking than the EEC. And as for the Human Rights Court, you know, half of them aren't even qualified lawyers. We're being run by incompetence. No, we're not being run, we're being supervised and instructed by incompetence, ignoramus. And then our super service, which also do a clean-up, has to try and implement them and impose all those regulations on the PBI in the army. That used to be a short for poor bloody infantry. Now it's poor bloody industrialists who have to try and make it work. Now we've got Mr. Corbyn coming out. Of course he's in favour of England staying in the EU because it's ridden with restrictive practices, rules and regulations that are a heavy burden on the people who manufacture the wealth. one way or the other. Then filters down. Ugh, oh, where to start? You know, the fact that Corbyn supporting staying in the EU is probably any good news this week. I think if you listen to him and watch him on TV, which you can do, live in the House of Commons, makes you realise how useless he is, how he has no practical experience of running anything. I bet he hasn't even run a sweet shop. So what does he know about running a country? And the problem with Cameron and Osborne, they spend more time wearing a hard hat and a yellow high-vis jacket, talking to somebody in a factory, or pretending to lay a block, or tying a piece of scaffold, where they could be at their desk working and running and improving the country. Let's get out. I haven't heard one single solid argument yet why we should stay in. Just general smears. Great tragedy. You know? Just over two months ago now. And perhaps we can get back to the real world. Hopefully. Looking after our own fishing waters again. Getting all those fishing boats that are tied up in Whitby and Fleetwood and Hull and Grimsby out to work again. Catching fish in British waters and supplying it to British people. Sorry about that. Moving on.
Moving on, KB. Finally, we've had another listener with a question for you this week. Daniel P. Danny P. is asking, when you were working for Wembley, why wasn't it possible to keep the Twin Towers there?
Right, that's a very good question. And I'll give a very detailed answer. Because it took nearly a year to establish it wasn't practical to keep the Twin Towers. And for reasons which I will explain. The old Wembley was badly designed, though I suppose this era wasn't bad. But only 74% of the seats in the old Wembley had a clear view. 26% had it partly obscured by the columns which held up the roof. So we had about 75,000 capacity. And most of them were unsuitable. But that's all we knew, so let's get on with it. So, of course, the great thing was save the Twin Towers. Must preserve the Twin Towers. In fact, that was English heritage attitude in the first place. The problem is that we had to... We inspected the condition of them, and I must confess, they were really imposing sight when you came up Wembley Way, first thing that came into view. And like most people, I actually thought they'd been built on with stone blocks. In fact, they weren't. They were, the idea being, of course, that you dismantle them, label them, and then reassemble them in their new position, because they couldn't say where they were. Reasons I'll tell later, but in fact they were reinforced concrete with just a facade around them. And unfortunately, because nobody spent any money on them in maintenance, because Wembley all had money troubles, they weren't in very good condition. Why did they have to move? Well, once we designed the new stadium, they'd be stuck in the middle of the playing pitch, looking quite exciting, seeing Vardy dribbling around them on his way to goal, or Bobby Charlton for that matter. So they had to be moved. And the first idea was, as I say, was maybe to dismantle them and move them to the end of the Wembley Way, so they would be the imposing, welcoming towers between which you walk to get to the stadium. And we tried every way we could think of it. There was even one way at one time, an idea, came up with an idea of putting scaffolding around them to hold them together, each individual tower to hold it together, and then jacking them up and moving them on rollers the half a mile they'd have to go. But it just wasn't feasible. Somebody quoted us £20 million to do it, which in itself wasn't, you know, a showstopper. But they couldn't guarantee success. Because every danger, they'd just collapse. And the other idea I had in mind when I first took over was that they could be used as offices. But of course, they were rotten inside. There were no cross bearings at all. So that you just have two hollow, empty edifices whose only advantage was that they looked good on the outside. And of course, the other thing is, in the old Wembley, they dominated the edifice. I mean, that they dominated the appearance. But in fact, in the new Wembley, that had been dwarfed by the huge stadium in the background. So, A, they couldn't stay in their existing position. B, they were not, as we thought, built of blocks. It was reinforced concrete in one lump. C, there was danger that if we tried to move them, they'd collapse anyway. D, there was no guarantee we'd get them in the right position. And finally, E, until we moved them, we wouldn't be able to start the demolition of the old Wembley, which would mean that the building time would be extended by probably at least a year, assuming nothing had gone wrong. So it wasn't feasible. But the new stadium we have is magnificent. And what's clever about the design, it doesn't have the fish fork or needle or knitting needles holding up the roof like so many stadia do at the moment. So sorry about it, but life had to move on. And it's now a 21st century stadium instead of a 19th century stadium. And we managed to move the seats close to the pitch because the government or the sports council originally wanted a running track on the inside, which, as you remember, the old Wembley meant we were a long way away from the action. Despite the fact that they'd never been used for Olympics or any other athletic sport since the 1948 Olympic Games. In fact, Wembley turned it into a dog track at one time to make some money. It was a great pity that we had to lose those towers because they were symbolic. I'm afraid at the end, that's where they were, symbols of bygone era. I know it's nice to have history. It's more important to look back and build on it, which is what we did.
Well, thanks very much for that, KB. Well, we'll look forward to chatting to you at the same time next week.
Thank you.